Engaging in Bodhisattva Behavior, Chapter 7, Joyful Perseverance. Patient like that, I need to embrace joyful perseverance, since based on perseverance, enlightenment takes place. After all, without joyful perseverance, there's no arising of positive force, just as without wind, there's no motion. What's joyful perseverance? It's zestful vigor for being constructive. Its opposing factors are explained as lethargy, clinging to what's negative or petty, and, from being discouraged, disparaging oneself. Lethargy arises from apathy about the problems of recurring samsara, which comes through relishing a taste of pleasure from idleness and through craving sleep as a haven. Sniffed out by the trapper, the disturbing emotions, and fallen into the trap of rebirth, how do you still not realize that you've landed in the mouth of the Lord of Death? Don't you even see that he's slaughtering the members of your herd each in turn? Yet despite being like a buffalo at the butcher, you even go to sleep. With the road blocked everywhere and eyeballed by the Lord of Death, how can eating bring you joy? How can sleeping? How can making love? So stock up on a bountiful store of positive force while you can, for death will come all too soon. Even by throwing off lethargy then, what can you accomplish when out of time? With this still not done, this just having been started, and this still left half done, and the Lord of Death having come all of a sudden, and the thought arising, oh no, I'm destroyed, and seeing relatives, their faces with red eyes swollen from the force of grief, and flowing with tears, having lost all hope, and also the faces of the messengers of Yama, tormented by the memory of negative acts, hearing the screams from the joyless realms, body befouled with excrement because of fear, having become delirious, what will you do? If, like a live fish flopping about to be cooked, you'd have such terror in this lifetime, is there need to mention the unbearable tortures of the joyless realms when having created so much negative force? Baby skin, even at the touch of hot water, you're scalded. How can you sit back at ease like this, doing karmic deeds for a joyless realm rebirth? Dreamer of results without any effort, weakling, waster of plenitude, seized by death and having the airs of an immortal god. Oh dear, with these miserable ways, you're destroying yourself. Seated in a boat now of a human rebirth, cross over the mighty river of suffering. With this boat being so hard to catch again, idiot, it's not time for going to sleep. Letting go of the joy of the hallowed Dharma, the best and unending font of joy, how can you find any joy in such causes for suffering as shenanigans, joking, and the like? So don't get discouraged. Amass the supporting forces. Readily accept and take control of yourself. Then equalize self and others and exchange self for others too. Never get discouraged by thinking, how can there be enlightenment for me? For the speaker of truth, the thusly gone Buddha, has pronounced this truth like this. Even those who've become gnats, mosquitoes, hornets, and worms likewise too shall attain unsurpassable enlightenment so hard to attain by generating the force of zestful vigor. How much more so for someone like me, having Buddha nature and born as a human, able to perceive what's of benefit or harm? Why shouldn't I reach enlightenment so long as I don't quit bodhisattva behavior? Suppose I said, but it frightens me that my arms, legs, and so on are to be given away. Well, I'm being reduced to fear by a state of bewilderment from failing to discern what's heavy or light. For countless millions of eons, I'll be gashed, stabbed, burned, and split open innumerable times, and still won't attain enlightenment. But the suffering I'll have in achieving enlightenment is something with a limit, like the pain from an incision made on my body to remove the harm from a foreign object festering inside. All doctors, in fact, bring freedom from sickness through the discomforts of medical treatments, so a little discomfort must be endured to kill off a plague of sufferings. Yet the foremost physician hasn't offered the usual healing treatments like these, but rather cures countless chronic afflictions with an extremely gentle procedure. As a start, the spiritual guide prescribes giving away a vegetable and the like. Once accustomed to that, one may eventually, through stages, come to give away even one's own flesh. When the insight arises that my very own body is similar to a vegetable and the like, then as for giving away such things as my flesh, what hardship would there be in that? After all, from purging negative karmic force, there'll be no more suffering. and for becoming mentally proficient, there won't be any more mental stress. But similarly, from distorted conceptions, the mind gets hurt, and from negative force, the body. Through positive force, though, the body has joy, and with mental proficiency, the mind becomes joyful. So even remaining in recurring samsara for the sake of others, what could depress a compassionate one? Because the strength of his bodhicitta aim is depleting his negative forces from the past and gathering oceans of positive force, he's explained as surpassing the Shravaka listeners. So, mounting the horse of the bodhicitta aim, which dispels all depression and exhaustion, and journeying from joy to joy, who with a sensible mind would ever become discouraged? Thus, the supporting forces for fulfilling the aims of limited beings are strong intention, steadfastness, delight, and letting go. Strong intention is developed from the dread of suffering and by reflecting on its benefits. Uprooting opposing forces like that, I shall strive then to further my zestful vigor with the forces of strong intention, having pride, delight, and letting go, also readily accepting and taking control. But the faults of both myself and others that I'll need to vanquish are boundless. And when the depletion of each individual fault will take oceans of eons, and even a fraction of that initiative for depleting those faults can't be seen yet in me, then how is it that my heart doesn't burst the fathomless sufferings that I'll need to endure? The excellent features for both myself and others that I'll need to actualize are also enormous. And there, when the repeated practice for each individual feature will take oceans of eons, and I've never developed the repeated practice for even a fraction of the excellent features, it's amazing how I've rendered meaningless this rebirth somehow attained. I've not made offerings to the vanquishing master, nor provided the joy of magnificent feasts. I've done no services for the teachings, nor fulfilled the hopes of the poor. I've given no freedom from fear to the frightened, nor offered comfort to those in distress. It comes down to all that I've produced is only discomfort and the pain of an alien object in the womb for my mother. Since such a poor mess has come about through my lacking a strong intention for the Dharma in former lives and now, who would ever give up strong intention for the Dharma? The sage has chimed, a strong intention is the root of every constructive facet. And the root of that is constantly having meditated on the ripening results of karma. Pain, foul moods, and assorted forms of fear and being parted from my like come about from behaving with negative karmic force. Consider this. By enacting the constructive deeds that my mind has intended, wherever I'm reborn, I'll be honored through their positive force with an oblation as the karmic result. But by enacting negative deeds, though I wish for happiness, wherever I'm reborn, I'll be assaulted through their negative karmic force by weapons of pain. By constructive behavior, I'll come to stay in the presence of the triumphant as a spiritual child of the blissfully gone, with a superb body, born from a lotus opened by the splendor of the sage, and dwelling in the heart of a spacious, fragrant, cool lotus, my radiance shall grow with nourishment from the triumphant's melodious voice. But by serial destructive behavior, I'll fall onto a fiercely flaming iron ground, horribly tortured by Yama's henchmen, ripping off my entire skin, pouring into my body molten copper liquefied by enormous heat, stabbing me with flaming swords and daggers, and rending my flesh into hundreds of bits. Hence, I shall set a strong intention to do what's constructive and make it a habit with regard. Undertaking it, then, I'll make it a habit of having pride through the lines in the Vajradvaja Sutra. Examining my talents first to undertake something or not undertake it, it's better not to undertake it at all, not to start it and then turn back. For that turns into a habit in future lives, too, and causes negative force and suffering to increase, while other undertakings and the time for their results are weakened and do not succeed. Actions, disturbing emotions and abilities, pride is to be applied regarding the three. It's something that I myself shall do, is having pride regarding actions. Worldly beings, not under their own power, due to disturbing emotions, are unable to accomplish their very own aims. But I'm not incapable like wandering beings, so I'll do this for them. How can I stand by while someone else is doing an inferior job? If it's because of being proud that I'm not doing it instead, then best to let pride be exterminated in me. Even a crow makes itself act like an eagle when encountering a snake that's already dead. But if I remain timid, even the slightest setback impairs me. Discouraged and having given up effort, will there be liberation due to feeling bankrupt or what? But by strengthening my effort through having my pride, even huge things will have difficulty triumphing over me. Therefore, with my mind steadfast, I shall set back setbacks. For if setbacks bankrupt me, my wishing to triumph over the three realms becomes a joke. I shall triumph over everything, and nothing shall triumph over me. As a spiritual offspring of the triumphant lion, I shall maintain this pride. Wandering beings conquered by pride are disturbed. They have no pride. For those having pride don't fall under the enemy's power, but instead have power over the enemy, pride. Filled up with a disturbing emotion of pride, they're led by pride to the worst rebirth states. And even as humans, their festivity is killed. They become slaves, eating the scraps of others, stupid, ugly, feeble, and insulted in all situations. If filled up with pride, those having trials are also included among those having pride. Then what kind of pathetic beings are they? Tell me, please. But those who hold on to their pride in order to triumph over the enemy pride are the holders of pride, the triumphant heroes. And those who kill off the enemy pride, even though it's gargantuan, bestow then the fruit of triumph in full on wandering beings, whatever they wish. So, when standing amidst a horde of disturbing emotions, I shall hold my ground proudly in 1,000 ways and not be thrown off by the pack of disturbing emotions like a lion with jackals and such. Just as a person would protect his eyes when events of great danger actually arise, likewise, I'll never fall under the power of disturbing emotions when danger actually arises. Let me be burned to death or even have my head chopped off, that would be better, but I'll never in any way bow to the enemy disturbing emotions. Likewise, in all situations, I shall never do anything other than what's fit. Like someone wishing for happiness as the result of play, any positive actions a bodhisattva is engaged in, he clings to those actions and delights in those actions, never having enough. Although people do actions for the sake of happiness, it's not clear that they'll become happy or not. But for a bodhisattva whose actions in fact bring happiness, how can he be happy without doing those actions? If there can never be enough desirable sensory objects, though they're like honey on a razor's edge, how can there ever be enough ambrosia of positive actions, which have as their ripening sweet happiness and peace? So, after completing a positive action, I'll plunge into the action that's next right then, like an elephant parched by the midday sun when encountering a pond, plunging into the water. But, following upon a decline in my strength, I'll set my activity aside to take up again. And having completed it well, I shall leave it, with thirst for the next and the next. Then, like engaging a sword in a duel with a seasoned opponent, I shall parry the disturbing emotion's thrusts and decisively stab my opponent, the disturbing emotions. Just as someone having dropped his sword in a duel would snatch it up quickly out of fear, so having dropped the sword of mindfulness, I shall quickly snatch it up, mindful of the fears of the joyless realms. Just as poison on the blade of a sword, finding blood as its carrier, spreads throughout the body, similarly a fault when finding an opening spreads throughout the mind. Like a terrified person carrying a jar filled with mustard oil, with someone keeping in front, poking with a sword, threatening to kill him if he spills a drop, someone with taming behavior needs likewise to hold on tight. Therefore, just as I'd swiftly stand up at the slithering of a snake into my lap, likewise at the slithering in of sleepiness or lethargy, I shall swiftly repulse it. Scolding myself in each and every occasion of a lapse, I shall contemplate at length, how can I act so that never again will this happen to me? With this as a motive, how can I make it a habit to be mindful given those situations? I'll aspire for the company of spiritual teachers, or the appropriate action they give me to do. Then the way to have force for all events before doing some action is that I'll rally and invigorate myself, recalling the chapter on taking care. Just as the wind coming and going takes control of a cotton ball, so shall I take control of myself with zestful vigor and gain in this way spiritual success.